This podcast is presented by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Enjoy the presentation.
I want to talk a little bit about my book, why I wrote it, how I wrote it. And George said all of us have a compelling personal story. That's true. Ralph Waldo Emerson said that all of us have one great book in us. I don't know if this is a great book or not, but it was a joy to write. And it was an incredibly cathartic experience. It was a freeing experience. I got a lot of gifts from doing this. I also got it published, and I got it published because of where I come from. It's difficult to get a book published. The thing about my book was, because, as George told you, because of who my parents were and what my lineage was, there was a lot of interest in my book. I didn't realize that at the time. My family, I come from a very political family, and I come from a very public family, but a very private family. Nobody's ever written a book like this except my grandmother Rose. My grandmother Rose Fitzgerald Kennedy wrote her autobiography in 1974. It was called Times to Remember. And it was a chronicle of her life, and it was an honest chronicle of her life. And it was all of us in the family celebrated that book. We all contributed to that book. I have a couple of pages that I was asked to write about my grandmother for that book. But she deserved to write a book. You know, my uncle, President Kennedy, wrote a book about Profiles in Courage. My uncle Bobby Kennedy wrote a book about the Cuban Missile Crisis. My uncle Ted Kennedy has written books about about national health insurance and the health crisis in this country. I compared myself to those people. I didn't think I had a book to write. You know, I really thought, you know, what do you have to say? And I have a lot of funny stories, and I have a lot of interesting, I've led an interesting life, but I thought, you know, I don't, what do I have to say? And about 4 years ago, I had what I call a midlife opportunity. I don't call it a midlife crisis like many of us do. But I came to a place in my life, I was, you know, 46 years old, 45 maybe, and I looked at my life and I thought, who are you? Who is Chris Lawford and what has he done in his life? And I began to question a lot of things. I began to change a lot of things. I began to really examine my life on a very deep level. And about at that time, I got a phone call from a writer. His name was Lawrence Lehmer. He was writing a book about the Kennedy men. And he wanted to talk to me. And he said, oh, I'm talking to some of your cousins. And I said, wait a minute. Can you just tell me why in the world needs another book about the Kennedys? Because I, for one, think there are probably too many of them. And he said, well, you know. And I said, no, write me a letter. And just answer that question. And then I'll read your letter. And I'll decide whether I want to talk to you or not. So he wrote me a long letter about one of my cousins who had some amazing story that he thought needed to be told of overcoming adversity. And I said, you know what, Larry, if you had told me that you needed the money or you wanted to impress a girl, I might have talked to you. But the only reason that story needs to be told is if my cousin needs to tell it. And it got me to think, you know, because people have been writing stories about my life ever since I was born. I was born on the beach in Malibu, California. As George told you, my mother was, my father was a movie star. He was a big movie star. He was much more important than my mother at the time. It was 1955, and my father had a major Hollywood career. And, some of the people hanging around our house were Marilyn Monroe. She taught me how to do the twist when I was 5 years old. And people ask me, they go, what was it like getting taught the twist by Marilyn Monroe? And you have to understand, I was five. So to me, she was just like this kind of like quiet friend of my parents who people seem to pay a lot of attention to. But the thing that you did notice when Marilyn Monroe taught you how to do the twist is the grown-ups paid attention. And Frank Sinatra was a very good friend. Well, actually, not in the beginning. Frank Sinatra and my father had kind of a falling out when he started to date Ava Gardner. Ava Gardner was Frank Sinatra's great obsession. And my father dated her, and when Frank found out, he said he would have my father's kneecaps broken. Frank said that a lot about people that he didn't like. He was going to have their kneecaps broken. He never did it, obviously, but my dad and him were definitely on the outs. But my mother loved Frank Sinatra and wanted my father to introduce her to him. And my dad's like, you know, Patty wants to break my kneecaps. I don't think that's a good idea. But my mother was very resourceful and very willful, and she set up a dinner at Gary Cooper's house. Rocky Cooper was his wife, and they were good friends, and invited Frank. And my mom sat next to Frank and charmed him. And Frank and my dad sort of made up. And, you know, my mom was very political. My mom understood, like, she comes from a political family, and she understood the relationship between Hollywood and Washington. And she understood that Frank Sinatra was interested because her brother was the junior senator from the state of Massachusetts. And he was not a national figure yet, but he was making rumblings. And Frank was definitely interested in getting into the political world. And my mother was interested in Hollywood and how that might affect any future elections, and also interested in my father's career. And Frank Sinatra was somebody who could help my father's career. So Frank was a fixture in our life and actually became my sister Victoria's godfather. I had godfather envy from a very young age because he would come at her birthdays with these ridiculous presents for a four-year-old. And I had a godfather whose name was Peter Saviston, and I don't ever remember meeting him. He was sort of a beach friend of my father's and never gave, you know, never gave me anything that I remember. So, you know, these were some of the people. Milton Berle was there. Milton Berle used to smoke these cigars, and he'd always put a toothpick in the end of the cigar. And one day he came up to me and goes, "Kid, you know why I put the toothpick in the end of the cigar?" I said, "No, Mr. Berle, why?" He said, "Because that's where all the good juice is." And I mean, I'm 6 years old and looking at these people, and they're wonderful and they're crazy. When I was born, I was born at a hospital called St. John's Hospital in Santa Monica. My mom was there at the same time that Judy Garland was there. Judy Garland and my parents were really good friends. As a matter of fact, when my Uncle Jack died, she was the first person to come to the house, and she stayed until my parents came back from the funeral. And she used to play the piano all the time and sing. Now, to me, at six, that was a nightmare. Judy Garland singing was a nightmare. But to an adult, I mean, people paid a lot of money to see Judy Garland sing. But we were born, my mom and her were in this hospital, and she was up for an Academy Award for A Star Is Born. And so there was media all around, and the press was paying attention. And that's the other thing about my life, is that from a very young age, I was born with the American dream fulfilled. And I was also born with the media paying attention. They weren't necessarily paying attention to me, but they were paying attention to the surroundings of my life. And from that day, Joe Luft, who was the son that was born to Judy Garland on the exact same day in the exact same hospital as I was born to my mother, him and I had our birthday parties at the Beverly Hills Hotel every year. And completely inappropriate for children, but our parents were looking for an excuse to have a party, so they would bring us and they'd sit us on the opposite side of a big table, and their friends would have a party and they would give us gifts, and we would, you know, it was fun because we got a lot of toys. In any event, this was what I was born to, and I talk about this because I start the book this way because, in addition to all of this, I was also given a good dose of alcoholism. And my book is a lot about that because I'm Irish, and I've heard it said that God invented alcohol to keep the Irish from ruling the world. My family almost proved him wrong. But, I was alcoholism didn't just run in my family, it galloped. And from a very young age, I don't know where it actually came from. I used to think, you know, was I born with this? Did my parents give it to me? Did I pick it up at school? I don't really know. I do know that after my mom and dad, when I was born in that hospital, the story is because back in the day, in 1955, men didn't go into the delivery room with women. And the women would go and the men would wait somewhere. My dad was waiting at a restaurant called Madame Wu's, which was this great Chinese restaurant on Wilshire Boulevard. And he was having Chinese chicken salad with Cary Grant and waiting for the phone to ring. And Cary Grant was telling my dad, don't worry, your career may not be going very well right now, but as soon as you get a little gray hair, everything's going to change. It did for him. So my dad was feeling kind of better, and the phone call came, and he hightailed it to St. John's just in time to see me being wheeled out of the delivery room. Now, when I was born with what they call a Mongolian fold. It's also called bedroom eyes, which is, it's kind of a good thing to have because you sort of have these sultry eyes, and apparently it's attractive to the opposite sex. But when you're born, you look Asian. And my father saw me coming out of the thing, and he looked at me, and he goes, that's not my child. Because I looked Chinese. And my mom, he walked into my mom's room, and she was sitting up in bed with a bottle of Dewars and saying, come on, let's go have a drink. We got a big, beautiful boy. And they left the hospital, legend has it, and they went to this bar that they used to go to on the beach called the Beachcomber Bar. And they put me in my bassinet, they put me on the bar and ordered their favorite cocktail. I suppose my mom thought of it as kind of a hip Malibu neonatal unit, but it was the first place I went in this world, you know. And the thing about, what's interesting is I grew up, the house that I described where all these incredible people were, and my parents were amazing. I mean, one of the great things about writing this book was you get to see your parents as people. You know, I always looked at them as my mom and dad, and all of us have families, and all of us have parents, and, we have that stuff between intergenerational stuff. And I've had it with both my parents, but in writing this book, I got to see them as people, and to see how they fell in love and how their marriage fell apart. And I got such compassion for who they were, and I love them both deeply. And the house that we grew up in was this amazing house that was built by Louis B. Mayer. Louis B. Mayer was one of the great moguls of Hollywood. And it was this amazing house. My dad did not want my mother's father, who was Joseph P. Kennedy, who was a very wealthy man, to buy the house for them. So my father wanted to pay for his own house. My dad had a very strong instinct not to buy into all of that. And so he bought this house, and it was a beautiful house on the beach in Santa Monica, and it was a heaven. It was heaven for a kid. I had the backyard. My backyard was this amazing beach with Santa Monica Bay, and down to the left I had the Hilton kids, and up to the right I had this guy named Steele Hunter, who was my friend. His father was Jeffrey Hunter, who used to play Jesus of Nazareth in all those really bad Easter Jesus movies you used to see. And I used to run back and forth between these two places, and it was magical for a kid. And when I was trying to decide what cover to put on this book, I was sitting with Lana one night, and the publisher wanted to use this picture of me, which nobody really likes, and because they wanted me on the cover, because they don't have a lot of imagination. And Lana and I were thinking, Lana said to me, why don't you use this picture, because this is one of my favorite pictures. It's a picture of me and my Uncle Jack in 1959 at that house, it's got a picture of me kind of looking like a deer caught in the headlights, which is kind of what it was like being born into this, because this was a pretty remarkable thing. And him looking kind of like a movie star. And me, if you notice down here, with my little hand down there, I have my middle finger extended. So I've already got that kind of alcoholic FU personality. But the reason, not only because I love this photograph, but this photograph really, really sort of sums up a huge part of my life, because what happened was this house I was really happy in. When he came, after he became president, he would come and I would raise a presidential flag, and I went to school with the nuns, and I was kind of a little special because if you're the nephew of the first Catholic president, the nuns kind of like you and they give you a break. But I love my life, and my parents seemed happy. They didn't seem that miserable, and I had a good life. I just remember it as being I was content. And then on November 22nd, 1963, everything changed, and it changed for me in a way you know, it's difficult to talk about this, and it was difficult to write about it, because I think everybody in my family feels this way on some level, but none of us have ever acknowledged it, because it was too big. You know, when both of my uncles were assassinated, they were big political public events. They affected the entire country, and in some respect, the entire world. But they were also private murders of family members. I mean, I don't know how many of you have had somebody murdered in your family, but that's what happened. And none of us, I mean, I could never acknowledge that. I could only go, well, now I got to go to St. Patrick's Cathedral, where I'm going to be the altar boy in my Uncle Bobby's funeral with the whole world watching. So that was it. But 1963, I remember, I was at the my school, St. Martin of Tours, and I was in class, and Sister Maria Aloiez, who was our nun, was this big, mean woman who I found it difficult to believe was a woman, was tormenting us about something, and these two women from the office came to the door, and they knocked on the door, and they looked really upset. And she looked around the classroom, and they all were looking at me. And I was like, oh, no. Because when people came from the office, it was something bad was going to happen. You were going to go home, or you were going to go to somebody's office. It was not a good thing. And so she went like this, and they brought me out into the hall, and they said that somebody in my family was hurt very badly or dead. And one of the women was crying, and the other one was really upset, and I couldn't figure out what it was, and I thought it was my grandfather, because, you know, I was 8 years old, and when you're 8 years old, you can't believe that somebody like Jack Kennedy could be dead, because to me, Jack Kennedy was a guy who was just life. I mean, he was so full of life. I mean, when we were in Hyannisport as kids, he would come in, you know, that Marine helicopter, and he would land on the lawn of my grandfather's, and all of us kids would be waiting, and we'd jump on his golf cart, and we'd fight for a place on his car. I mean, it was just, he just had this, when he came, life began. It was kind of that deal. And they said, I thought it was my grandfather, Joseph P. Kennedy, who had had a stroke and was in a wheelchair and looked like he was dying or should be dead. And so I didn't understand it, but they said, no, it was the president. And they said, do you want to go home? And I said, no. I said, no, I don't want to go home. And that afternoon, I went and I played baseball, and I hit 4 home runs. I had never hit 4 home runs in my life. But I was invigorated by this. What it was the attention. Because what happened immediately was I participated in an event with my family that affected the entire country in the most profound way. I mean, before 9/11, so November 22nd was the date that everybody knew where they were. You know, that it was, and so the amount of attention before November 22nd, I didn't feel special. I didn't feel that my family was special. I mean, I remember going in 1960 to the Democratic Convention, where my uncle got the nomination to become president of the United States, and my mom was a delegate, and they had it at the sports arena in Los Angeles, and I was 5, and they brought me. And I, you know, I don't know how political all you guys are, but, you know, politics and show business are both things that if you experience them from an early age, you're kind of screwed, because once that stuff gets into your blood, it's hard to get it out. And I went to the sports arena. I saw all these people. You know, I saw the big room and the people with the crazy hats and the signs, and everybody's laughing and screaming and the speeches, and I was like mesmerized. And of course, I got tired before anything good happened, and they brought me back to my uncle's hotel room. They put me to bed, and about 2 o'clock in the morning, my uncle Jack and my mother came in and woke me up and said, and my uncle sat on the bed, I'll never forget this, and he looked down at me, he said, Christopher, something like this, I can't swear this exact, but I write all of these little dialogues, because he said, Christopher, I've been nominated to run for the president of the United States. It's going to be a very difficult job. Will you help me? And I looked up at him and I said, sure, Uncle Jack, but can we do it tomorrow, because I'm really tired. And, you know, and so that's who he was. And my parents, you know, my mom left my father when she was pregnant with me. She went back and had 3 more children. Their marriage was not good from an early time, because both of them, they got married when they were 30. And they probably never should have married. You know, my dad was a beach guy. He loved to be on the beach. He started surfing in Malibu. You know, he was just, that was him. He was an actor. He loved girls. He just shouldn't have married. And my mom, if it had been a different time, would have been like a CEO of a corporation. I mean, she had a mind for business. She was smart. She was strong. She could have done anything. But back then, having babies, especially if you came from that kind of tradition, you know, getting married and having babies was pretty much what you did. And so that's what she did. And they wanted to get divorced, but they couldn't get divorced because my mom was the sister of the first Catholic president. And in 1964, my Uncle Jack was up for re-election. And if she had gotten divorced, it might not have been good politically. So my dad went back. They had a conversation in the White House. And it was decided that they would wait until after 1964. And when my uncle was killed, they didn't have to wait anymore. And I went to New York. And my life changed. You know, in 1969, after my Uncle Bobby was killed, I was in eighth grade, and I had two friends that would get together on the weekends and drop acid. And they kept asking me if I would do it with them. And I said no, because I knew that it was the wrong thing for me to do. And one day, I said yes. And my life changed. And for 17 years, much of what this story is about is my dark journey into drug addiction and alcoholism. And, you know, I was the kind of alcoholic, you know, I started when I was 14. When I was 20, I had a heroin habit. And for 9 years, I tried to get sober. I went to college. I went to law school. I held jobs. You know, I could show you the resume. I was a functioning addict, but I was still an addict. And I could not get off drugs. I tried everything to get off drugs. I tried psychiatrists. I tried geographics. I tried, you know, going to law school. I tried everything, but I couldn't. And then when I was 30 years old, what I believe what happened to me was a moment of grace, which came into my life, and I surrendered. I reached a level of surrender that you only hear about. It's like, you know, addiction, I've described it as similar to dancing with an 800-pound gorilla. You keep dancing until the gorilla stops dancing. Well, my gorilla was dancing with me and punching me in the face for 9 years, and I got tired of it. I got to a point where I became so sick and tired of being sick and tired that I surrendered, and I became willing to do it differently. And that was the moment that grace came into my life, and I believe it was divine, and changed my life. And a lot of this story is, and I'll finish with this, a lot of this story is about that. You know, people that read this book, you know, they pick it up for either the Kennedy stuff or the Rat Pack stuff or any of that, but this is a story about addiction and recovery. It's a story about a man who found himself and who was given what all of us want in this world and squandered it, turned his back on it, and in a very ungrateful way, and who got a second chance, and who got to come back and acknowledge what he had. And you know, my life now for the last 19 and a half years has been about trying to reclaim all of that. I've been talking about recovery in a public way for the last year and a half, and I'll finish with this. But it was very nerve-wracking for me because people have asked me for years to come and speak, and I don't do that. I go to my recovery groups, and I keep it very personal. It's the most important thing in my life, and I keep it very personal. But when I wrote this book, I realized I would have to be public about it. I went up to Indianapolis to give a speech to a big fundraiser for a hospital up there, and they asked me if I would do some press the morning before. And I went to this radio TV interview at 6 o'clock in the morning, and a woman put a microphone in my face, and she said, "Chris, what's it like being a heroin addict?" And I went, "Oh, my God. I don't want to be talking about this on TV. This is a mistake. This is not good." And I stumbled through the interview, and I go to the next interview, which is a radio interview, and I'm sitting in this radio room, and I'm looking out on this window on this great square in Indianapolis with all these wonderful war memorials, and I'm thinking about how I'm going to get out of this. How am I going to stop this roller coaster? And a guy walks up. He's African-American. He's 55, obviously homeless. And he puts a sign on the window that says, "Can you help me get sober?" And I thought, it's a sign from God. Now, there were speakers outside, so he could hear what I was saying. But the point was, this guy, and I went to see him after the interview, his name was Lawrence. He'd been living in a dumpster for 10 years. And he said, "Man, I've been trying to get sober. I can't." I said, "Look, go to the hospital. that I'm here for. And I was with the marketing director. He goes, I don't have any money. I said, here's $5. There's a bus over there. She goes, oh, they're not going to take me. I don't have any insurance. The marketing director gave him her card, said, they'll take you. And so he shuffles off, and I get in my car, and we're going to the next interview, and I'm watching this guy walk off with $5, and I'm thinking, he's going to go get a pint. There's just no question about it. I mean, I know alcoholics. I'm one of them. And he goes, 2 hours later, the woman calls me up. She goes, guess who's here? And Lawrence was there. And he gets on the phone. He goes, Chris, you know what? He goes, I didn't want to come to this place, but, you know, I shuffled over to that bus station, and the first bus that came was going right to the front door. And it turns out that radio station that I was in that morning was owned by the guy who gave the money to that hospital to start the rehab 30 years before. Now, you may call that coincidence. I call it God. And that guy, Lawrence, got sober and he got a new life. So this book and my work is about that now. It's about, you know, sharing my experience, strength, and hope so other people, you know, it doesn't matter. Alcoholism is an equal opportunity disease. I mean, it affects all of us. I'm blessed because I got sober and I had a life to come back to. Many people don't. Many people have a lot of heartache and hardship to come back to. But anybody can get sober and with help they can. So now I'd like to answer some questions if that works.
I had not heard Chris speak before. And so there's always this question in your mind. I knew he'd have great stories to tell, but this has transcended great personal stories. This has been special, and we're grateful to you, sir, for coming and for sharing your story with such remarkable candor. The book is Symptoms of Withdrawal. We have copies available. He'll be happy to sign. In fact, if you don't mind, if you'll join Mark at the back table so we can do that. Let's express our appreciation.
You've been listening to a podcast from University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at www.uctv.tv. Thank you for listening.